This is The Guardian.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. No miracle at Stamford Bridge. Real Madrid turned up, were put under a little bit of pressure, and then just showed us all the composure that Chelsea lacked. To be fair to Frank Lampard, his attacking midfielderless side controlled things and created chances, but those chances didn't fall to attacking midfielders because they weren't on the pitch. What now then for Chelsea, the rest of their season, and for Todd? Can't keep out of the dressing room bowly. Meanwhile, not many people gave AC Milan a chance of making the semis. A lot of people wanted Napoli too, but you can't always get what you want. And a stoic defensive display and one stunning Rafael Leao run. It means we're not far away from a Milan derby semi-final. There's Liverpool's demolition of Leeds in the Premier League to cover, Leighton Orient's excellent floodlight failure promotion success, and our friends from Mundial join us to talk about five-a-side pickup games. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Nicky Bandini, welcome.
Morning.
The Racing Post's Mark Langdon, hello.
Hi, Max.
And hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Max, and a belated happy birthday.
That's very kind of you. Let's start at Stamford Bridge then. Chelsea 0, Real Madrid 2. Real Madrid through 4-0 on aggregates. A lot of chat, Mark, before the game about Frank Lampard not picking any of his attacking midfielders. But did he actually get this setup kind of right?
Yeah, I feel like he did. I mean, it is, it's very trendy, isn't it, to just slaughter everything that Frank Lampard does and sort of laugh at every tactical, I suppose, idea and, you know, team selection. But I felt like, and Carlo Ancelotti said it afterwards, that they were put under a lot of pressure in that first half. And I think that one of the reasons that they were put under pressure was because they were, you know, Real Madrid weren't able to get into a rhythm in midfield because Chelsea had, you know, more, I suppose, sort of defensive-minded players in those positions rather than, say, a Felix or a Raheem Sterling. So, I think that Chelsea played reasonably well. And even though those chances did fall, Max, as you mentioned, to maybe players that you wouldn't have wanted them to in N'Golo Kante and also Cucurella, they were really big opportunities. And even, you know, left-backs or, you know, central midfielders not renowned for goal-scoring, I think would take that opportunity, you know, a fair percentage of the times. And had Chelsea gone 1-0 up, it really could have been an interesting tie. The problem was, and you saw it with the goal, as soon as Chelsea did overcommit and start to push players forward, there was always the threat of Rodrigo and Vinicius on the break. And that's what ultimately did for Chelsea. I think from Lampard's point of view, you didn't want to go gung-ho in the first 20 minutes, concede a goal, and then the tie basically be over. So I think to keep it tight and to try to just score first and make it an interesting game was the right approach. It was just that, you know, Real Madrid are just much further along their progress than what Chelsea are.
I think Trevor Chalobah is still sliding, isn't he? First goal. I mean, Mark said, described people who have sort of laughed at everything Frank Lampard has done as trendy, which I think might in a way be a compliment to you, Barry, as someone who is now trendy. I don't know if that's fair. I think we have laughed a lot at Frank Lampard. And I kind of think we owe him a little bit from yesterday that he did set up pretty well.
Yeah. I don't think we've necessarily laughed at him personally, but more at this situation he's found himself in and the mess he's inherited and whether or not he's the right man to sort it out. Yesterday was undeniably Chelsea's best performance under him in four games, but it's a very low bar. They've lost all four games and they've only scored one goal, and that was a bit of a fluke, you know, to be honest. But he set up pretty conservatively. It worked up to a point. Real Madrid still created chances. Carvajal caused Chelsea lots of problems. And Real Madrid didn't really have to exert themselves to win this tie over two legs. It was fairly straightforward. But if this is Chelsea, that they should be a lot better than this, you know, and giving it a go, if getting a pat on the head for that is what we're reduced to doing to them, you know, oh, well done, you didn't get tonked. It's not great, is it?
No. And I suppose, Nicky, there's this always this feeling about Real Madrid that they are playing within themselves. They're just doing the right amount to win each game. And it's impossible to say, but, you know, had Cucurella scored that chance just before half-time, you think the fans would be really on it. Would they have just said, you know, let's just do a bit more? Like Benzema and Vinicius sort of barely played yesterday, but it didn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, just on the Lampard thing, I mean, like this situation that Lampard finds himself in, like that isn't something that he had some control over. I mean, look, it was, I agree that like it's ridiculous to judge Frank Lampard on this one game or even this tie, because I don't think many managers were taking Chelsea past Real Madrid, frankly, right now. But he chose to take this job. He didn't have to take this job. And I think it was a very odd choice of job to take, honestly. Like, I understand the emotional pull of it going back to your club that you feel strongly for. But I think, put it this way, I think you can look at sort of stronger minded individuals when it comes to these sorts of decisions. And for instance, Paolo Maldini, who turned down working with Milan many times because he said the project isn't right. Like, I'm not coming there just to be sort of the patsy, basically, to be the sort of nice face because everyone loves me, of a project that's failing. And he finally took the job when he started to believe in what they were doing. And it's working pretty well for him. I think you can have that sort of strength of your own convictions. And look, it was definitely not a straightforward job to walk into, given the mess that is there. But I don't think Frank Lampard gets a free pass, as if he sort of woke up one day and someone had put him in that job. He chose it.
That's so interesting. Because I until you've said that, I kind of always thought, well, he just had to say yes, didn't he? Like, because you never know, you could win the Champions League, right? But yeah, perhaps he shouldn't.
Could you? I mean, you should be able to, right? Like, you've the team spent what, 400 million or so, something like that, ridiculous, on reinforcing the squad this season. On paper, it should all work, but it's not like there was any evidence from the way they were playing under Graham Potter that this team was just like a tiny little sort of tweak away from going on to beat. And I have to say that sort of the other side of this, I feel like there's been this sort of consistent refusal in Britain to acknowledge how good Real Madrid are. They won the Champions League last season. It was like, oh, well, you know, they just kept having these lucky comebacks. Like, oh, Real Madrid just sort of find these goals from somewhere. And the idea that if Chelsea scored once in this tie, that suddenly they would come undone, like they have never faced adversity before. Even some of the coverage of City I've heard, it's like, oh, well, City, when they were thumping Bayern in the first leg, well, they've pretty much won the tournament now. You've got to go through the champions, the team who currently hold it. Like, I don't get it. I don't get some of the coverage that Real Madrid get in this country. I think that, you know, they have quite a lot of evidence showing they're quite good, actually.
Yeah. Barry?
But just going back to Lampard, there seems to have been this perception that taking the job was a no-brainer for him because it was kind of a free hit. And no matter what happened, if it didn't go well for him, it wouldn't be his fault. But I think taking this job could do his future prospects of getting a half-decent managerial job irreparable harm, because if you look at his recent record as a manager, in his last 14 games, he's lost 12 of them and drawn two. That's with Everton, that's with Chelsea. As we discussed on Monday, Chelsea have a very difficult run-in. There's every chance the players, you know, they're more or less pupils in class with a supply teacher in charge. They've nothing to study for. There's no exams coming up at the end of the summer. They could very well down tools. Well, down tools even more. And have a disastrous run-in and finish well down the table. who's going to give Lampard a job after that? I don't think there'll be a stampede to his door when vacancies arrive, in certainly in the Premier League or even maybe the Championship.
We had a supply teacher once, and he walked into the room and he said, "Hi, everybody. My name is..." And as he said my name, as he flicked on the overhead projector... Do you remember those? Do you remember the overhead projector? Yeah. And just written on the overhead projector was Guinea-Bissau from a previous geography lesson. And the poor guy was totally screwed for the rest of time, known as Mr. Guinea-Bissau. And God, what a tough gig supply teacher was. Anyway, more importantly, I mean, the thing about Real Madrid is, Mark, they showed with those goals, especially Valverde in the second, just that total calmness in the penalty area, at the key moment in a football match where you just have to make the right decision, delay the pass, play the pass, whatever, and they just got it spot on twice.
They absolutely did. And, you know, Valverde's had a difficult time, I think, in, you know, probably since the World Cup, really, both on and off the pitch. And so we haven't seen him on the pitch play at a sort of the level that he was showing maybe before the World Cup, but in that one movement, just absolute class, the way that he danced past those Chelsea defenders. And I felt from Real Madrid's point of view, you know, so often it's Karim Benzema that is kind of the different... I know Vinicius is playing fantastically well, but it's Benzema that knits it all together. And he, I don't know if he was struggling with an injury slightly, he definitely wasn't at the level that Benzema can play at. And Real Madrid still found other ways, and it was sort of the third forward, if you like, really, in Rodrigo that was decisive in the overall game. I do think from a centre-back point of view, actually, that I prefer it when Rudiger plays at the heart of that defence alongside Militao rather than Alaba. I would say I think Real Madrid look more solid when it's those two together. But going forward, if you allow them space on the counter-attack, like, it doesn't have to be Vinicius or Benzema. It can be Rodrigo. And that has maybe been a difference from last season when obviously Ancelotti used to play Valverde as the third forward, and that he would bring in an extra central midfielder because they had Casemiro. It'd be interesting to see, obviously, and they're playing in the semi-final, another level of opponent. We presume it's Manchester City, but even if it's Bayern Munich, whether Ancelotti sticks with that front three or feels like he needs an extra midfielder in there just to add protection, because whether it's City or Bayern, both have got, you know, huge amounts of quality that can really hurt Real Madrid.
I think Sid was saying this last week. You know, one of the things with Benzema is one of his great strengths is just how well he vacates space for others, right? Like how well he knows how to sort of get out of space and get out of the way of others. And I think that's the thing. Sometimes you don't sort of see him having his sparkliest game, his shiniest game, but he's helped to make that space for either Vinicius or Rodrigo to get those runs and score those goals.
What now for Chelsea, Barry? Look, failed to score in 18 games this season. That's the most games since 80-81 for them. Lost their fourth successive game for the first time in 30 years. Only FC Copenhagen have failed to score in more Champions League games than Chelsea this season. Frank Lampard said, "I think the word broken is a bit much." Are they broken?
Broken. They have too many players. They need a clear out. They should probably appoint a new manager sooner rather than later, ideally, you know, in the next couple of weeks, so he can survey the wreckage of the season, decide who's worth keeping, who to get rid of during the summer. They clearly need a centre forward, whether that's Romelu Lukaku or somebody else. You know, there's a story that Todd Boehly went in the dressing room after the Brighton game and said they were embarrassing themselves and apparently singled out one senior player for a particular amount of opprobrium. One imagines that will not have gone down well with the players.
But it is weird that, isn't it? I mean, actually one insider reading, I think Jacob was writing about it, said it was all a bit weird.
Well, it's weird in an English Premier League dressing room, I suppose. It's not weird in an American locker room, is it? It's quite commonplace, I think. So, but yeah, it's another misstep by him, you'd imagine. But I think even though a lot of what's going on is his fault, he does have a right to be angry with this. You know, the player, these are not Sunday League football. These are very good footballers. Whatever 11 Chelsea put out, they are all very good footballers and they're just not delivering.
I think they've just got too many of the same players. That's what it feels like to me. You look at, you know, like Mudrick and Pulisic and then Raheem Sterling, you know, as three of the wide players. They've got others as well. And, you know, how many wide players do you want to play in the team if you've got three really good wing backs like what they've got already in Reece James and Chilwell? And Kukurea has not played as well as what he did at Brighton, but they spent a lot of money on him. Even with the centre backs, I feel like a lot of those do the same type of job. Like, you haven't got one that maybe really impresses in stepping out from one of the sort of side centre back positions. And then Felix and Kai Havertz, and again, they're not sort of traditional number nines, but they like to play up sort of off the front, really, and sort of or play up and then drop deep. So just, and even Mount and Gallagher, like, you know, they could be the same player as well, really. So it just feels like it's not only they've got too many players, they've got too many of the same players, and they've spent all that money and they still haven't got a striker that you would trust, and they haven't got a goalkeeper that I would trust either. And, you know, that's absolutely crazy, really.
Richard says, how many times did Lampard pat Ancelotti on the back, and was that too many? It was a really long, manly hug, wasn't it? Jonathan writes, how much do you think Olivier Giroud regrets turning down a move to Everton in January? So look, AC Milan are through to the semi-finals for the first time since 2007. I mean, not many people, Nicky, thought they'd get past Napoli when the draw was made. They had 20% possession in this game, but they did defend brilliantly, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really sort of bears repeating. I tweeted this last night. Napoli are Serie A's top scorers by almost 20 goals. Like, they're miles ahead of everyone in terms of goal output in Serie A. They were the Champions League's, and they still are the Champions League's joint top scorers with Man City this season. In the Champions League, the only team they'd failed to score twice against was Liverpool in the second leg, in the second game of the group stage, where it was a dead rubber and it didn't matter, right? So they scored at least two goals in every other game. And Milan played them three times in 16 days between the league and the Champions League. And they didn't concede until the 93rd minute. I think it's extraordinary. I think it's genuinely an incredible performance by Milan. And I think that there's perhaps, to me, it feels like this sort of collective, almost sort of downplaying it going on at the moment, where everyone's sort of looking around. I think there's understandable disappointment because Napoli were so spellbinding earlier this season. There's understandable disappointment of, oh, you know, we thought this team could really do it all. They could win the whole thing, and that sort of journey's at an end. But I think to sort of dismiss the idea that Milan could be a semi-finalist on merit when they are last season Serie A champions, when they did tactically, I think, just play smarter in these games. They got some luck. In the first leg, Kvaratskhelia should score in the first minute. In this game, he should score at the beginning of the second half. There are chances for Napoli in these games. It's not like they shut them down so absolutely that Napoli didn't have any chances. And of course, both teams in this second leg missed a penalty. But I still think what they've done, sort of handling that, is really extraordinary. And I think what is sort of... There's so many things to pull out of it, but I think what it certainly points to for me is Stefano Pioli, over three games, outmanaged Luciano Spalletti. He was the one who made the adjustments, who made the little tinkers every game and made the right calls over and over again.
Mm. And Barry, in Rafael Leao, they have like the perfect counter-attacking midfielder. That run is just so much fun, isn't it?
Yeah, he, for anyone who didn't see it, he picks up the ball in pretty deep inside his own half, sets off, runs and runs and runs and runs, and goes past two players, or two and a half, cuts inside Amir Rahmani and squares the ball unselfishly for Giroud, who just has a simple task to stab it home from 6 yards out. And Liao has been very good in these two games, and I believe, Nicky will know better than me, that he hasn't had a great time of it since the World Cup, but seems to be hitting his stride at just the right time for Milan.
I think this has been a bit of a mixed bag of a season overall for Liao. He was Serie A's MVP last season, and I think there's been times when he's looked like that and times when he hasn't, but I think definitely there was a bit of sort of post-World Cup funk, you might say. There's one thing I just want to sort of pick up on quickly, sort of referring to the luck that I talked about. In my opinion, that the two yellow cards to Anguissa in the first leg were very harsh. And Anguissa then misses this leg. Anguissa was brilliant in the first leg, I thought, by the way. And his replacement, Ndombele, gives the ball away for that goal. So
sad for Ndombele. He actually had a decent game, didn't he? But like, that is a really bad miscontrol. I suppose it's a long way away. You wouldn't think, oh, this guy's going to set up a goal in a minute. But it was quite Ndombele-like.
Yeah, and it was also, to then flip it to the other side, it was very Milan-like. And I think this is sort of the thing. Can Milan win the whole thing now? Well, I mean, I think they've got a very solid chance to reach the final. They're going to be playing either Inter or Benfica. I don't think either of those teams is a team that they're incapable of beating. And I think whoever they face in the final, they're going to be underdogs against if they get to the final. They might lose those teams as well, but if they get to the final, they'd be underdogs. But I think what's actually sort of fascinating about Milan is if there's any team in Italy that I sort of feel like I think can win as an underdog, it's Milan because of that, because of how they scored this goal, right? Because Milan, at their best, have shown they can defend pretty well. They haven't conceded in the Champions League knockout rounds at all, of course. And I think it's what, 5 games now going back to the group stage, or is it 6? I can't remember. If you give them that half a moment, it's not just Leao, it's Brahim Diaz. Both of them can just go like lightning. Both of them can just make that run, make that breakaway, and then it just requires someone to put the finish on it, which on this occasion was Giroud, but sometimes it can be them, sometimes it could be in the first leg, it was Bennacer. So they are a team that actually can be quite comfortable with the underdog role and with sort of a bit of backs to the wall, because they know that when they need to hit fast, they can hit really, really fast. And so, yes, Leao is a player who thrives in these counter-attacking situations, and I think when he does it, it's really scintillating and exciting to watch.
On those penalties, Mark, I mean, Giroud missed that one at 0-0. Alex Meret, the first goalkeeper to save a Champions League penalty against AC Milan since Jerzy Dudek saved Shevchenko's in the 0-5 shootout. Napoli should have had a penalty in the first half. I can't believe VAR didn't overturn that one. And then Kvaratskhelia misses one with 10 minutes to go. It's a brilliant save from Mike Maignan, Mark, but it's a real shame that that didn't go in, just in terms of we sort of haven't had a lot of entertainment yet in these quarterfinals, and that would have been an amazing last 15 minutes, wouldn't it?
No, it feels like over the last decade, there's been so many great Champions League comebacks, and you know, with 10 minutes to go, if that penalty goes in, maybe you've got another one. Stadium was, we would have been absolutely chaotic at that point. Just in terms of Maignan, I mean, how good is he not only saving penalties, which he's very good at, if you know, we're talking about an underdog that maybe is going to win a knockout game, having somebody that can save the penalties that he does is obviously an important part of it. I felt that Napoli, though, the crowd, obviously, they're a very important part of the way that they play, but it felt too sort of frantic at times, and you know, there was a lot of crosses just going in, and that, I mean, Milan just wanted those crosses in, and eventually they did score from a ball into the centre, but generally speaking, it's a low percentage play to just keep on sort of hoofing it into the middle. And when they won that penalty, that was when they actually refused the opportunity to cross, played a more intricate passing, and managed to get down the side easier. So I felt like maybe it was the crowd, maybe just the occasion, but just a bit rushed from Napoli, and maybe didn't take their time. You know, it was enough time, even when they were 1-0 down, to get back into that game. But it's still, I just hope that, if presuming they do go on to win the Serie A title, that this doesn't sort of become but it's only the Scudetto, you know, because it's still a huge achievement for them. But this will feel like a bitter disappointment. Just one player we haven't mentioned, but Calabria, the Milan right back, I thought he was probably man of the match, really, the way that he defended.
Nicky, on the subject of Napoli fans, has there been some sort of issue between, like, didn't Spalletti actually sort of talk to the ultras to sort of say, come on, we need to get together and all be as one? Which seems strange that the ultras wouldn't be happy with what's happening at Napoli at the moment, given how well they're going.
Yeah, God, this is one of those conversations where I feel like we probably don't need the full story of it all for the podcast, but it's hard to distill really quickly. Essentially, that there's been like a long-running sort of unhappiness with sections of the ultras towards the club's owner, which on the surface going to look extraordinary because Aria De Laurentiis took this club from bankruptcy, got them back to Serie A, and they've now been in Europe for 13 seasons running, which is the longest streak of any team in Serie A. But there's issues that go to the fact that he's not considered, he's not Neapolitan, he's from Rome. Some people dislike that. Some people dislike things he said about the city. Some people dislike all sorts of things that have happened in his ownership. And recently there's been issues about security measures at the stadium and also like a fan membership card that fans are supposed to sign up for to get tickets. And it got to a point where in the first game against Milan, which Napoli in the league, Napoli lost 4-0 to Milan. It was this shocking result out of nowhere. And it was played at home in a stadium which was almost silent because you had the ultras on strike and so they weren't chanting. And I actually think that is part of the story of them getting knocked out, because I was thinking about what Mark was just saying and the sort of the rush to cross. And I think the psychology of playing a team three times in 16 days is part of it. Part of it is you know each other so well now and you have ideas about each other. And did some of that build a sense of panic among them? God, we haven't scored against this team twice in two games. In that first game, the atmosphere was completely dead. And basically Spalletti, after the first leg away at San Siro, said, if it's going to be like that again, I'm done. Like, I'm leaving. Like, I'm not hanging around. And that kind of pushed this sort of need for a rapprochement between ownership and the ultras. Aurelio De Laurentiis, the owner, took a photo together with some ultras, posted it on Twitter. But it was a big story, Max. When I say, like, there's a longer version of this story, the government were involved. The Minister of the Interior helped to broker this peace between De Laurentiis and the ultras. And De Laurentiis had been given a police protection. He'd been given like a police escort in the days building up to this because they were worried about threats and his security. It was a really sort of specific and I think very sort of localized story that was going on between ownership and the ultras. But yes, there was this sort of official coming together, I think 2-3 days ago now, and it did result in a good atmosphere at the stadium. Just to say, like, I don't think any of it will dampen the Scudetto party. This is still the third ever Scudetto. It's the first one since Maradona. It's going to be bonkers in Naples. It's going to be not dampened at all. And they're 14 points clear. They're going to get that Scudetto. It's not going to take away from them.
All right. Well, we'll find out tomorrow who AC Milan and who Real Madrid will play. And we'll talk about it tomorrow as well. In part two, we'll talk about Liverpool's demolition of Leeds on Monday night.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Leeds 1, Liverpool 6. Leeds have conceded 5 goals or more at home in successive games, which isn't great, Barry.
No, it isn't. And it's very worrying. They're not in the relegation zone, but those two second half capitulations at home must be hugely worrying for Leeds fans. I mean, Javi Gracia, when he was appointed on 22nd of February, I think, fairly underwhelming appointment. Started well, win over Southampton, lost one, drew one, won one, lost one, won one. You know, so they've beaten Southampton, Wolves, Forest, drawn, good draw with Brighton. And now these two defeats. They have had injuries. Wilfred Nanto's been out. Tyler Adams, I think, is out for the season with a pretty bad hamstring injury that needs surgery. So they're big, big losses for them. But some of the defending for these goals is inexplicably bad. While it's difficult to point the finger at Ilan Meslier, who just seems to have no competition for his place. And he's a very good goalkeeper, but he's also very young and he's also prone to a gaffe. And maybe is it time to take him out of the firing line? Because picking the ball out of your own net 11 times in two games, you know, it's not good for morale, is it? And it was a very, very good performance from Liverpool. And we haven't seen too many of them on the road this season. I think this might only be their fourth win away from home in the league this season. Yeah, Leeds very bad, Liverpool very good. And I think there's been some bafflement in certain sections of Leeds fans that Liam Cooper wasn't playing in this game and that Gracia doesn't seem to think much of him or rate him. Pascal Strijk had an absolute nightmare. He should probably be benched after these two games. And yeah, not looking great for Leeds. But, you know, as I said, they're still not in the relegation zone.
Mark, Liverpool looked, you know, dominated this entire game, basically. And when you see them like this, it makes you think that maybe they don't quite need the squad gutting that we've previously reckoned. Or is that, you know, they've have won, you know, it was something like 40% of their goals have come in three games this season, like this one, the Man United game, and beating Bournemouth 9-0. It's a sort of, Liverpool season has been weird, but when they play like this, you think, oh, just one more player.
Yeah. I mean, Crystal Palace scored five past Leeds like last week, didn't they?
Yeah, but it's the all new Roy Hodgson gung-ho Crystal yeah. Palace, Mark.
It is. I think that it would be a mistake if Liverpool sort of, it might actually not do them great if they finish the season quite well and feel like everything's, you know, going great once more, and you know, it doesn't need surgery to that midfield. I wouldn't read too much into beating Leeds. What was interesting was, I think, obviously Curtis Jones, because he's somebody I think that is being given an opportunity, and this is, if there are any positives to take from Liverpool, you know, being in, playing out this season without too much pressure now in the final matches, it is to see, I think, whether Curtis Jones is good enough to play for Liverpool on a regular basis. Alexander Arnold playing, you know, in central midfield when Liverpool have got possession. And, you know, we had, was it over 150 touches in that game at Elland Road. So that, I think, will be more interesting for me to see whether Alexander Arnold can move into that position. It makes sense to give it a try because Jurgen Klopp has spoken about how much money Liverpool have got to spend. It'd be much easier to buy a right back rather than a central midfielder. Midfielders cost more money. If Trent Alexander-Arnold can develop in that position, then you might save yourself 50, 60 million that can be spent elsewhere. But no, I still think that Liverpool need to replace Fabinho and Jordan Henderson in terms of regular starters, I would say.
David says, what is the name for Trent's new position? The inside deep-lying full-wing playmaker Deuter. And most importantly, what does it mean for the Premier League next season? Do you feel, Nicky, that I reckon sort of in British terms, Trent Alexander-Arnold probably, he probably takes up about 40% of all discussion about all football. It's very strange, isn't it? Why
is that? Just because of a lot of syllables, you know, Trent Alexander-Arnold.
Yeah,
you know,
possible.
That ends up being.
But you take my point. Like, I feel like there are players who play whole careers who don't get mentioned on Monday Night Football or on this or anywhere else. And there are some players that just seem to like attract there's so much discussion, so many column inches written about these certain players. Perhaps it's just his sort of abundant natural talent.
I would be interested in comparing, you know, airtime on TV, podcasts, radio and column inchage, you know, say, James Tompkins and Trent Alexander-Arnold. Yeah.
It's not fair, is it? Yeah. Craig Cathcart's not getting a lot, is he? Let's be honest. You know, where are the deep dives into where Mark Albrighton can play on both sides? I don't know. I mean, I asked you the question, Nicky. I don't have an answer for it, but it is interesting.
No, I don't have an answer either. It is odd, though. Like, I do feel like you sort of hear his name being talked about lately, and it almost sounds like people are sort of talking about someone who, oh, you know, he's had his heyday, now he's over there. He's 24 years old. Like, it's weird how he's being discussed at the moment. Like, you know, he's obviously a talented player who's already won incredible things in his career. Maybe he's just not having his best patch of form ever. Like, it does feel like it's a very particular. I agree with you. I feel like I've heard so much big picture discussion about Trent Alexander-Arnold in the last few months. It does feel like it's a bit much.
Great to see Ben Mee in the bright lights of the Monday Night Football studio, presumably talking at length about Trent Alexander-Arnold. And Kev says, Curtis Jones had to fully untie and tie his laces live on TV while 40,000 Leeds supporters screamed at him to hurry up. Can the panel think of a more anxiety-provoking situation? Because I had a mild panic attack watching it. You would get it wrong, wouldn't you? You would just slip and go, oh, I've got to start again. Anyway, in the EFL last night, Leeds and Orient were promoted from League Two in quite fun circumstances. The floodlights went out at Gillingham's ground. So players were taken off the pitch. The other games continued. When the lights came back on, Orient had gone up in that time. And the video, Baz, is great, isn't it? Of just, Dillingham didn't care either. So no one's playing. They're just sort of, it's like the Simpsons football match.
Yeah, I saw a clip on Twitter. And it's just various Gillingham defenders tapping the ball to each other. None of them being pressed by any of the Leighton Orient players who are more or less celebrating, even though there's still 4 minutes left. Interestingly, under the tweet, quite a lot of people got angry about, you know, oh, it's a disgrace. Gillingham could earn more money. You know, some Gillingham could work on their goal difference. And some Gillingham fan, well, we don't need goals. We're safe. We're fine. And yes, but if you finish higher up the table, you get more money. It's just, you know, it's this funny thing, and people still managed to get really enraged about it. And even when the lights were out and the players had been taken off, so it's pitch dark, and you can hear the Leighton Orient fans just singing, celebrating their promotion. So well done to them.
They were also olaying every Gillingham pass that was going along the back four. Which that was my favourite bit of it. The Orient fans olaying.
I'm trying to think
of back pass.
A better way to find out you're promoted than in pitch black, just at an away end in the pitch black game. Doesn't matter. Anyway, also in League Two, good night for Northampton and Stevenage. Both won, consolidate their places in the top three. Their nearest challengers, Stockport and Carlisle, drew with each other. Harrogate, the only team near the bottom to win. In the National League, Wrexham beat Yeovil 3-0. They need one win from their last two and they are promoted. Luke says he'll go up from League One automatically. 2 points separating Plymouth, Ipswich and Sheffield Wednesday. Plymouth were one down at Shrewsbury, eventually won it in the 96th minute. Ipswich needed a late winner at home to Port Vale. Sheffield Wednesday won at Bristol Rovers. So Plymouth have 89 points from 42. Ipswich 88 from 42. Wednesday 87 from 43, Plymouth have the nicest run in, despite being, or perhaps because they are home to Cambridge on Saturday. I'm fucking terrified. We were robbed 2-1 at home to Wickham last night, but no one in the bottom half won last night. Kevin says, can we have some Luton love, given their remarkable run to the Championship playoffs once again? The only club in the top two divisions to shun gambling money on ethical grounds, fan-owned and run, top three in a sea of parachute payments and with a bottom three budget, etc. Would anybody like to shower Luton some love?
I think, Max, as well, you could add in the fact they're doing it with a former Watford manager that was sacked earlier on this season, you know, for not being good enough for them. So that will make it extra sweet. I think defensively, been absolutely outstanding under Rob Edwards. They've only conceded 36 goals.
Who's that? Is that Mal Donaghy and Steve Foster, who are still doing it?
I'm not sure who they
it's okay.
The key
Don't
men
worry.
Are for Luton. But you know, they've only scored 53 goals, which you probably wouldn't have you in third place ordinarily. But you know, so strong at the back. Playoffs are going to be tough. I couldn't believe I'd looked at the table this morning and I assumed West Brom were like mid-table the way their fans were moaning about a fortnight ago. And they're up to sixth now after a couple of wins. So it's going to be a very competitive playoffs. I watched Middlesbrough the other night against Norwich and they look very good. You know, Luton, I still wonder if there's maybe going to be one team that's maybe too good for them in the playoffs. But it has been a remarkable story. And Nathan Jones obviously started it and then continued it. But yeah, the job Rob Edwards has done since he came in, fantastic.
If a question, and you may not have the answer, but if Luton did get promoted, would Kenilworth Road be fit for Premier League?
Will the Cola Dome be finished by next season? Wasn't that the ground they were going to move to in like about 20 years ago? It's a good question. To answer your question, Barry, and I know this off the top of my head, we didn't just pause recording for a short amount of time, but I am reliably informed by producer Joel that according to a BBC article, it would cost them £10 million in ground improvements. So still probably worth it on balance.
Oh, absolutely. But I just wonder, would they those improvements be, would it be possible to do them in time? I mean, it's quite a shout. It has a certain charm, Kendallwort Road, but which is my way of saying it's
yes.
a bit of a dump. It needs a lot of work.
Yeah, well, it's one of my favourite away ends. It's a great away end. You walk through people's houses. Maybe like all those people who live there can get their bathrooms done as well while they're bulldozing that. You can have a wet room if you live around the back of that. Burnley aren't champions yet. They drew with Rotherham. Sheffield United almost certainly up with them after a 1-0 win over Bristol City. Wigan kept their faint hopes of survival alive with a win at Stoke. And worth pointing out regarding West Brom, before everyone yells at you, Mark, they still have a lot of problems off the pitch, even if things are going okay on the pitch. And it's a story we've covered and we will cover again, of course. Right, that'll do for part two. Part three, James Bird from Mundial joins us to talk about the latest issue of his magazine.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk to James Bird from Mundial magazine. Their latest edition is out. How are you, James?
I'm really well, thanks, Max. How are you?
I mean, good. We mainly got you on to talk about your dad's forensic love and planning of Wolves, but we will get to that later. Cover story is about pick-up football, which is... I'm not too old for it. Clearly, I know I'm not. Anyone can do pickup football, but I've never done it before. Tell us what it is.
Okay, so I think the reason that we did it was the last sort of like four or five issues we'd done legends, we'd done Maldini, we'd done Zidane, we did Messi and R9 and so on and so forth, and we just wanted to change it up. So I jumped into a car and travelled the country with photographer and art director to explore this weird subculture, which is pickup football. So it's organised football for complete strangers. It's not seven-a-side after work. It's not Sunday 11-a-side. It's not even really grassroots. Most of it is organised online. And Barry, if you want to play football this afternoon, if you've got an hour spare and you type in London 2 p.m. onto a couple of these forums or the Sector Leader app, which is Footy Addicts, up will come three spaces at Archbishop's Park or four spaces at 2 p.m. at Westway. And you'll arrive and there will be someone, a host with a ball and bibs, and there'll be 14, 15 other people who have also done the same thing and are looking to play football. So it's sort of this weird place in between playing with your mates and not playing at all. And I think, Max, like what you just said, it's open to everyone. So the brilliance of this style of football is that you can have a veteran centre-half from Northampton who's played 2,000 games of football in their lives coming up to play, being on the same team as a 18-year-old who's just arrived from Bolivia. And all of a sudden, you've got to work out who plays centre-half, if you can speak the same language, how you're going to make a game of football work for your team.
So this is like, when I was growing up in Cambridge, there's this expanse of grass called Parker's Piece, and the first ever rules of football were put up on it. But like on a Sunday, we'd go down with our friends, and there might be like eight of us, and then people would just turn up on bikes generally and go, oh, can I join? And you'd be like, yeah, you can play. Hang on, just wait for one more. And eventually you'd end up with like 20 aside. So it's a sort of a modern, slightly more sensible version of that.
Yeah, I would say so. It's like that, but more organised. So Footy Addicts, who are sort of, they sort of have the biggest community of sort of these brands. And they have something like 15,000 active players per week. I think there's something like 3,000 games that go on at AstroTurf pitches all across the country. And I think what we wanted to do was sort of show the stories that come out from these games. So there's 15 interviews in the article. And in that, you've got a 68-year-old who plays three times a week. You've got Chelsea Weston, who is only a very recently ex-professional. She was playing for Venezia and Bari last year, and she played for Doncaster Bells and for Birmingham when they were sort of the pioneers of women's football at that time. You've got a guy called Jason, who only started playing 3 years ago and has played 700 games in the 2.5 years since he first played. So you've got all these sort of brilliant people stories. And like the name of the article is Gods of the Astro. And I think the whole idea is that for an hour a week, or maybe 10 separate hours a week, if you're someone like Jason, you get to not think about anything else and play football with a group of strangers. There's no strings attached. Whether you score a hat trick or you score three own goals in your game, you might not ever see these people again. So it doesn't really matter. But you've had a kickabout.
James, if I turn up age 50, overweight, unfit, and not having played football for 30 years, and I'm on the same team as Chelsea Weston and the 68-year-old, who are both going to be much better than me, am I going to get bollocked for my ineptitude? Or
I don't think you're going to get bollocked, no. And I think that...
Because that's kind of what put me off playing five-a-side, because there used to be a guy in the group who, if I was on the same team as him, that was immediately my evening ruined, because all he did was bark at me for not being up to his lofty standard.
Well, I think that that's part of the brilliance of it, is that everyone's on the same page. Everybody knows that they're going to be turning up with people of different ages, of different abilities, of different genders, and it doesn't really matter. And I think Chelsea speaks about that really well in the article. The main reason that what she speaks about most is her turning up as a recently ex-professional, and immediately in the sort of 2 minutes where you have do kickups before the game, she's starting to sort of plan where she thinks people should play and how she can use your attributes, as well as Eddie, who is 68 and plays three times a week, and her attributes. I think she spoke really well about that. There's also a couple of other people that we speak to that aren't from this footy addicts sector, which is there's a guy who runs something called Terrible Football, and he started that in Bethnal Green 5 years ago, I think, and now they've got terrible football games all across the world. And he describes it really well as a celebration of mediocrity, which is something
I aspire to mediocrity. Yeah.
I'm just curious about how it's managed if there ever is someone who comes along who's difficult. Because I definitely know that experience from playing sort of informal football. Sometimes you do get people who either are taking it like ferociously more serious than everyone else, or someone who just is abusive to people. Like, if given it's all strangers coming together, like how is that managed?
Yeah, so I think we went to about 10 games across the 3 days across the country. And the only time that happened was at Westway in West London, which is sort of amazing. It's like the most concrete football can ever be. It's where those Joga Benito Nike adverts with Thierry Henry and Eric Cantona were filmed. And it's quite intense, like the noise echoes and you've got the cars going across. And one guy was too good in one of the games, and he started moaning at all the other players and throwing his arms up in the air and saying sort of, you know, the standard's gone down. And one of the players that we interviewed, Nicole, she went over to him. She was a brilliant player. She plays sort of 10 times a week, I think. She went over to him, spoke to him for 10 minutes, and then sort of got him down on a level. And I think that's what's really nice about this community, is that there's an element of self-governance to it. There isn't anyone really who has any seniority to it. So, and when people have to get along, when there has to be sort of self-governance rather than looking above in a hierarchy, you sort of have to make things work. And I think that was the one time it looked like there was going to be a flare-up, and it was just sorted out very quickly.
I loved the guy you spoke to who was playing a game and then suddenly realised he was playing with Ian Wright. And was a bit starstruck, but yeah. Is that Ian? Oh my God, I'm on the same team as Ian Wright.
Yeah, and I think I know that there's quite a few other ex-pros from the Premier League who play. I know that Darren Bent plays quite a lot. I know that Jack Wilshere has played. And I think that's brilliant. That's great with Ben, because he sort of said, he's like, at first I thought he was just a really good Footy Addicts player, and he had his snood on. It was a cold night. He had his snood on and his hat down, and then realised, Jesus Christ, it's Ian Wright. And I think Sean Wright Phillips has played as well. You do sort of get these golden nuggets, these like magic stories that happen within them, just because anyone can turn up.
Yeah, and look, the whole thing about football is it brings people together, right? Whether you're fans or you're playing like organised 11-a-side, 5-a-side, or this. And that story of the Welsh guy and the Iraqi guy, tell us that story because it's brilliant.
So, that's Yaya and Ben. And they met, they both moved to Birmingham at similar time, one from Baghdad, one from Cardiff. Both wanted a game of football, both got onto an online forum, I think, and then a Footy Addicts thing. They met on the pitch and they sort of spoke really nicely about how they had this connection on the pitch. And then they sort of started playing FIFA together. And then they sort of started hanging out more and watching Champions League games together. They now own a cafe together 2 years later. And I think Yaya's going to be Dan's best man in a couple of weeks. So like this sort of amazing relationship nurtured from one person playing a through ball to another that worked. And then they opened a cafe together in Birmingham. It's very sweet. They were very, very sweet.
Yeah, it's a great piece. And I am writing my annual. I'm going to start, my 38th season of amateur football this season. And I totally echo what you're saying about that. You know, I'm not thinking about, did my son drink the paint that he poured on his head yesterday that I should have put the lid on? I'm just thinking, can I volley the ball back to the thrower? It does, like, there's something about playing football that just totally clears your mind of anything. You're not thinking about anything else. And that is sort of the thing that keeps me coming back. Now, look, last time you were on, you shared your dad's very detailed breakdown of the goals Wolves would score. Like, he goes through each game, or no, he looks through the players and decides how many goals they're going to get. Remind me of exactly how it works and where we're at currently.
Yeah, well, where we're at is he's completely useless at it. But the format was that he went through Wolves' remaining games and decided that we needed 24 goals to stay up, and then listed each player in the squad and how many goals they would score. But crucially, this was before we signed Dawson, Lamina, Gomez. So it's a bit out of the loop, but Wolves are playing better now, aren't we?
Yeah. So what, he doesn't keep up to, he just does it once, does he? He doesn't do it like game week by week.
It was a one-off thing. His week by week thing is ringing the local phone in the local West Midlands football. He'll sit in the car on the drive and ring him up and tell him what he thinks. But no, I think that list that he made is outdated and useless now.
What a shame. But presumably, does he love Diego Costa? I mean, it just feels like that moment where it's sort of, it was a shit goal, but it was a sort of cult hero moment for Diego Costa at Molineux.
Yeah, I think we've needed a sort of new cult hero to cling on to, and he has completely embraced Wolves and Wolverhampton. He's constantly posting pictures of his kids in and around the city. He recently, I think 2 weeks ago, someone at Wolves told me that he texted the whole first team squad to say that all of them had to go and watch the women's team on the Sunday. And if they didn't go with him, then they had to dread to think what had happened to them. I think that what's happened to Wolves in the last couple of weeks is that our brilliant players who can do brilliant things, who weren't doing brilliant things, have now decided that they are going to start doing those brilliant things. So Mateus Nunes has been wonderful. João Gomez has come into the team and played really well. I think next season could be interesting for Wolverhampton Wanderers. Yeah.
I mean, it might not be, but it could be. And that's what keeps you going, doesn't it? Hey, James, thanks for coming on, mate.
Thank you very much for having me. Be soon.
James Bird there from Monday Owl Magazine. Buy it. It's great. A couple of AOB for you. Fergus Craig, the comedian, who's definitely worth following on social media, says, enjoying the latest Football Weekly as ever. Barry says he doesn't remember being very impressed by an Aston Villa performance, but am I right in thinking he once picked them out as outside title contenders? Or have I remembered that wrong? He then found proof. A tweet from August the 7th, 2014, which says, I'll obviously be tipping Aston Villa for the title again. Thanks for that one, Max. So, maybe you've never seen them play well, but you did tip them to win the title or get in top four or something in 2013, clearly.
I'm pretty sure I did not tip them for the title, but I said something that Jimbo deliberately misinterpreted and then made it. It became a running joke that I had tipped Aston Villa for the title. Obviously, I did not tip Aston Villa for the title. Why would I do that? I might tip them for the title next season.
Yeah. Imagine a host misinterpreting something you said and then running with it for time. Anyway, James says, "Hi, Max and crew. Greetings from Maryland in America. I thought I'd join the conversation about panelists' favourite phrases. I've been listening to the pod for about 3 years now, and 2 years ago I noticed Max's affinity for the word absolutely. After that, I couldn't stop hearing it. How he puts a tiny pause after the abs, pronouncing every syllable like a schoolteacher proving a point. The sound of Max's absolutely has become so ingrained in my mind that every time I hear it, I find myself getting angry. Anyway, thanks for the fantastic content. Keep it up. James, always appreciate the DC United shout-outs." Well, I'll see what I can do about that. Absolutely. And how I freight. I try not to pause. Matty says, "Does Mark Langdon like potted beef?" I reckon he does.
I don't hate it. It's not first.
What is it? Is that corned beef?
I just thought beef in a pot. No, is it not?
I don't. I mean, look, you're the meat man here. Potted beef.
No, I don't like that. No, sorry, I thought it was just. Sort of beef in a pot. No, I do not like that. No, it's like beef paste, as far as I can tell.
That's how I thought you'd brush your teeth with that, Mark. Frankly, I'm just disappointed.
Wasn't potted beef a staple for midnight feasts and picnics in Mallory Towers and The Five Find Out and The Famous Five and various other Enid Blyton books?
Don't think I've ever had it, to be honest.
Wow. Next live show. Next live show, Mark Langdon eats potted beef. Producer Johnson, we don't have that much time for potted beef. Fair enough. Finally, look, thank you to all the listeners who donated, to the listener Simon, who got in touch about the walk in memory of his son and to raise money for Sands United in Bristol. It is incredibly gratifying just to jump on that Just Giving page and see how many of you are genuinely good people, especially when money is tight for lots of you. So thank you.
What is the Just Giving page again, Max?
It is justgiving.com/crowdfunding/SandsUnitedBristolHike. And I tweeted it out after the last pod if you want to dig that out. But yes, one big community, this pod, and I saw that and I was quite moved this afternoon. So thank you so much. And that'll do for today. Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Max.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove with Arif Islam. Our executive producer is Christian Bennett, and we'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.